Hello, I'm Frank Kelly, and every day on the Radio National Hour, I take a deep breath and dive in.
If you can have a chip implanted in your brain to help control traumatic memory, then all you have to do is drop the adjective traumatic and it can control memory.
And he said, oh, well, we'll just take your stomach out. And in my head, I was like, how do you live without a stomach?
We're a funny species, Fran. You know, I think we're the only animal who seems to be hell-bent on their own destruction.
So if you want to know how to live without a stomach, or more about David Wenham's ideas for world peace, come find me on the Radio National Hour, right here on ABC Listen.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Siddham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, we're going to hear from a community traumatised by the return of Australian women with links to Islamic State.
Australia really became a homeland to the Yazidi community since 2014. Thousands were resettled, especially survivors. So when the news of repatriation was made public, a lot of the Yazidi community members became very concerned.
So what do you know about Australia's Yazidi community and the genocide perpetrated by Islamic State more than a decade ago? That story is coming up. And then later on, the former Midnight Oil's frontman turned politician Peter Garrett is launching a national public inquiry into AUKUS. He'll be along to tell us why. And you'll hear from the new One Nation MP for Farrah after the party polls as the most popular in the country. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. So last week, federal police held a community meeting in Wagga Wagga in regional New South Wales, and it was attended by members of Australia's Yazidi community. The Yazidis are this tight-knit and resilient religious and ethnic minority. They're indigenous to northern Iraq. For centuries, they've been persecuted. In 2014, a genocide perpetrated by Islamic State killed at least 5,000 people and displaced some 400,000. Targeted by the terrorist group for their religious and ancient pre-Islamic beliefs, about 7,000 Yazidi women and girls were actually captured and enslaved by the terrorist group during the genocide. Now, some 4,000 Yazidis call Australia home, and around half of them actually live in Wagga Wagga. Some of them say that they were surprised and shocked at the abrupt news of the return of Australian women with links to Islamic State. And some in the community have told the ABC that the return has been deeply traumatic. Two of the so-called ISIS brides who returned from Syria last month have now been charged with enslavement and the use of a slave. There have been similar legal proceedings in cases elsewhere around the world. Someone who knows a lot about those cases is Natia Navruzov. In Iraq, she leads an organisation called Yazda. It's a global NGO representing Yazidi survivors. Our producer, Pip Cook, arranged for her to come on the show. And when she dialed in from Iraq, Sally Sara asked for her perspective on the return of Islamic State-linked families around the world.
How concerned is the global Yazidi community about women who had links to ISIS returning to countries such as Australia, the importance of those women facing justice?
So Australia really became a homeland to the Yazidi community since 2014. Thousands were resettled, especially survivors, and they're currently rebuilding their lives and you know, they found in Australia a safe place. So when the news of repatriation was made public, a lot of the Yazidi community members became very concerned for several reasons. One is that it's a community that is still very highly traumatized. The genocide happened, around 12 years ago. It's a very recent genocide. It impacted the whole community, men, women, children. Everyone was impacted. And then second reason, I think the news was a shock because it was so sudden. Of course, we have been seeing repatriations in other countries where people were brought back as well. But, you know, I think it was just something that people woke up with in the news, and that also affected the way the news was received.
This is the first time that anyone has been charged with crimes against humanity offences under Australian law. How difficult is it to prosecute crimes such as this?
So prosecuting crimes like this is very difficult, although they're some of the worst crimes that humanity can experience, they're the hardest to prosecute. And one reason is that these crimes happen so far from where they are being prosecuted. So, here we are speaking about crimes that happen thousands of kilometers from Australia in ISIS, in former ISIL-controlled areas in Syria and in Iraq. So access to the evidence is very difficult. Authorities like the Australian authorities cannot just go and investigate crimes in Iraq and in Syria. Iraq and Syria also, for a long time were dysfunctional countries. And even until today, they need time to rebuild their judiciary, to be able to put in place efficient cooperation mechanisms with countries, to be able to provide them with the evidence. So that takes a lot of time. At the same time, ISIS members also concealed their identities, especially from survivors, by using war names. So a lot of the survivors can identify them physically, but do not know their real names. So this is also a reason why, identification of ISIL members takes a long time. And then, of course, there's this whole issue of repatriation. So let's say a country like Australia has a survivor that has information on ISIL Australian members, then you also need the perpetrator, the accused, to be within the jurisdiction of that current country so that the prosecution moves forward. Some countries do trials in absentia, which means even if the accused is absent and presumed dead, but a lot of countries, prefer to use costs and, their judiciary to prosecute actual people who are present. So for those reasons, although some of these crimes are the worst crimes that can be committed, it takes a long time to prosecute them.
Will your organisation be involved in these cases helping to gather evidence?
So YASDA was created, in 2014, 3 weeks after ISIL attacked Shingal. And since then, we have been documenting the crimes. We spoke to thousands of survivors. Documented hundreds of crime scenes, including mass graves, with the idea to be able to share that evidence with authorities that are willing to prosecute ISIS members, not only for terrorism, but also for core international crimes committed against Yazidis. So over, the last decade, we have been sharing already evidence with multiple countries. We have supported at least six countries now that have prosecuted ISIS members for crimes against humanity and genocide. And Australia now becomes the seventh country to do so. And we're already collaborating with the AFP for a while, and we're supporting survivors. And that support doesn't just end at sharing evidence. We also provide holistic support. We have psychologists, for example, who support the survivors in such cases. We provide interpreters. We also provide cultural sensitive advice to authorities that are dealing with Yazidis for the first time. So the support we provide is very holistic. And yes, Australia is also a country we have been supporting and will continue to support.
And that is Natia Navruzov, who leads the organisation YASDA, this global NGO representing Yazidi survivors. You can find plenty more ABC coverage on this story on ABC News Online, including a story from last month from Audrey Cordy, going through the other instances from around the world where Islamic State-linked slavery charges have revealed a bit of a pattern where most of the accused are actually women. You can find that story on ABC News Online. For the first time today, One Nation will have a lower house MP elected under its own banner and sworn in. David Farley gets the honour today as the member for the New South Wales seat of Farrer, a little more than 3 weeks after his landslide by-election win against Liberal and National candidates. The 69-year-old is an agribusiness consultant, he's a grandfather, and he comes to Parliament as support is surging for the party founded by Pauline Hanson. The latest AFR Redbridge polling we talked about yesterday shows one nation surpassing Labour's national primary vote. So this morning, David Farley joined Sally Sara and she asked just what today meant to him.
What does it mean to you to be sworn in today?
Well, it has a number of feelings to it. First, it's quite humbling to be the first One Nation member to enter into the lower house, the first One Nation member to represent Farah. It's also quite exciting that we've been able to achieve this, not only exciting for myself, but exciting for all the constituents of Farah, an extremely exciting and a proud moment for Pauline Hanson herself.
You're coming in a day after these Redbridge poll results, which show One Nation as the most popular political party in the country and Pauline Hanson as the most popular political leader. What's going on? How do you account for this significant rise in support for One Nation, particularly over the past few months?
Well, first of all, I think we ought to put it in perspective, as Pauline Hanson has. It is a poll. It's not a ballot.
True.
So polls have got elasticity to them. But what we learnt in Farah was, first of all, the art of listening, to actually understand what's going on within your electorate. And that can transfer over to what's going on within Australia at the moment. Australians, in particular, are very, very uncomfortable and feeling a lot of personal discomfort, family discomfort and commerce discomfort just in way the policies that are running and driving our country at the moment, whether it's the price of liquid energies, the price of retail power for houses or for homes in themselves. We've just trying to digest a bouncing rubber ball of a budget that the government has delivered that again approaches it from an aggressive tax angle, which is taking more discretionary spend out of the pocket. And more importantly, I think, is just where is the aspiration for Australia at the moment? People cannot put their head above the daily parapet and look at a target and say, we're going here. The government's having a lot of problems in articulating their narrative of where they want Australia to be, when they want it to arrive, and how they're going to do it. So there's a powerful amount of discontent across Australia at the moment.
Are you prepared to, on some occasions, vote on issues based on your personal beliefs and the electorate's view, even if Pauline Hanson may disagree with a position?
Well, if that arises, you know, I've got to address that. But first of all, I joined One Nation principally based on their portfolio of policies. I've been around the electorate of Farah, and the electorate of Farah via a ballot spoke quite loud and clear. I've tested a lot of what we achieved in Farah across a broader Australia base over the last week. I think it would be rare that we find ourselves in disagreement. But then again, I've got one job to do, is to represent Farah and represent it the best I can. And at the moment, the constituents of Farah have picked myself and One Nation to do that for them.
Will you commit to attending all sessions of Parliament?
Definitely my objective, unless, of course, there's something that calls me with a greater urgency outside of it. I've got a two-year window to be able to report back to the constituency of Farah and say, here was the platform that we went in on, and our platform was based on improving productivity and capacity for Farah. At that end of that two-year period, although it may even be shorter, show them the scorecard. So a lot of what I have to try and do and achieve will require my attendance in the Parliament. So, yes, I intend to attend as much as I can.
Should Pauline Hanson be attending more often?
Look, I'm not exactly sure if, besides reading the press on the weekend, Pauline's attendance record and understanding it, but it's up to Pauline to see where she's more effective, and I'll leave that to that question for Pauline.
And that is David Farley, the new One Nation MP for the seat of Farah in New South Wales. We'll return to the discussion around One Nation in just a tick with Liberal Senator James Patterson. So the AUKUS agreement got a bit of a shake-up this week, with Defence Minister Richard Marles announcing that the government will buy 3 second-hand Virginia-class submarines from the US. Now, the initial plan was to buy 2 second-hand subs and then 1 new one. as part of this $370 billion AUKUS deal. So today, a group of concerned Australians have decided to launch their own inquiry into this contentious and expensive policy. They're hoping to scrutinise the cost, the sustainability, and whether it's got ongoing public support. Spearheading the probe as the lead commissioner is a familiar name. The lead singer of Midnight Oil, longtime activist and former Labor minister, Peter Garrett. Now, he's making more announcements about this commission later today. So by the time you're hearing this, you may have already heard those details around who the other commissioners might be and exactly how this will work. But take a listen to this interview and you can hear why Peter Garrett wants to hold this inquiry.
Your inquiry has no standing with the government or defence. It's backed by crowdfunding. What are you hoping to achieve?
We'll give Australians the opportunity to ask the questions that haven't been answered up to now about this extraordinary deal, and to really do what I think should have happened in the beginning, which is to properly ventilate everything around AUKUS. I mean, you've been covering it a bit and we're starting to see more and more drips and drabs of information about the program emerge as things go wrong or things run late. But the fact is, this was the most significant and by far the most costly decision made in secret by an Australian government, tying us to two other sovereign governments and taking out an extraordinary amount of taxpayers' money on a proposition which has got a lot of distinct and very difficult complexities and potential problems lying up ahead. And Australians have never had a chance to have a debate about it, to ask the questions or to hear from the experts. So that's what this public inquiry will do.
How will it work and where will it happen?
Well, we're calling for submissions, people to put in their submissions and to potentially attend. We aim to go to a number of the capital cities, including Melbourne, we'll be in Adelaide, Perth because of Stirling, of course, Port Kembla. We'll look at whether we've got the capacity to do hearings elsewhere because it is crowdfunded and we certainly welcome the support from the public. But, you know, the incredible thing about this, Sally, is that I'll be launching this actual public inquiry in Parliament House, and yet in Parliament House they haven't had a full, vigorous and open debate about AUKUS, and yet it is the most significant decision by far, apart from going to war, that any Australian government in the modern era has made.
You're saying that answers are needed. How will you get those answers if defence and government officials are not required to appear at your inquiry?
Well, they're invited to appear, and I hope that they will. And we would welcome a briefing from defence. We would welcome briefings from the government and appearances. There are a number of experts, former military officers, intelligence experts, analysts and others, who've got good experience in the workings of government, in defence, in submarine procurement. And I'm expecting that some of them will appear. We have two former prime ministers, two foreign ministers, probably three actually, when I think about Alexander Downer's comments, have expressed very grave concern about it. So there's the opportunity for anyone to come into this public inquiry. It's a people's inquiry, as it should be. But we'd certainly love to hear from the government, and we've invited the government to come and present.
As you're saying, you'll be announcing the details of this probe later this morning at Parliament House. Who are the other four commissioners who will be presiding with you?
At the moment, I'm just letting people know that we're doing it. And I just think it's a really important, necessary and essential thing to do. I mean, you had a guest, I think yesterday, who explained in some detail some of the very difficult timing and delivery problems about this program. But I don't think people have had the opportunity yet to really consider what it does mean for Australia. I mean, foregone opportunity cost in terms of the amount of money concerned. We've written off the inland rail. That's one sub. We could put hospitals, pretty much new hospitals, say up to a $2 billion cost in most of the major towns of Australia with the amount of money that we're spending on AUKUS and so on. But even more importantly, and I think for me particularly concerning, we still do not have a safe nuclear waste storage plan.
And that is the lead commissioner of this new public inquiry into AUKUS, Peter Garrett. Well, we're going to tie those last two stories together with a nice bow. Liberal Senator James Patterson, the Shadow Minister for Defence, was on the program this morning talking about both of them. And Sally started by asking him about this week's AUKUS news, that Australia would now have three, not two, secondhand Virginia-class subs.
You've said you're concerned about a very serious capability gap that could emerge as a result. What is that gap?
Well, obviously, used submarines have a shorter lifespan than new submarines. The Virginia-class submarine has a rough operational life of 33 years. I understand from media reporting that we're going to get these boats when they're about a decade old. So that's a much shorter span of life in the water than we otherwise would have had. And it means they need to be replaced sooner by other submarines, and that's the SSN AUKUS program, which is the Australian program to build nuclear submarines with the United Kingdom. If that doesn't happen on plan and on schedule, and these are mega projects that have high risks, then you have a real risk of a capability gap emerging.
Why do you think this has happened? Is it possible this was recommended by Pentagon official Eldridge Colby in his review of AUKUS?
Yes, that certainly is possible. And if that's the case, I think the government should be transparent about that, because 3 years ago, they released what they called the optimal pathway to acquiring nuclear-propelled submarines. And in their optimal pathway, they said we would get at least one new nuclear submarine. So what has changed in the last 3 years to make it no longer the optimal pathway? The minister says, well, it's because these boats are going to be cheaper and they're going to be easier to operate. But if that's the case now, that was also the case 3 years ago. Nothing on that front has changed.
In the past week, we've heard US Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth singling out Australia for praise. If a second-hand sub is the price the federal government has to pay to maintain a good relationship with Washington, is it a price worth paying?
Not in my view, no. I think the most important thing about this program is securing Australia's national interest, about being able to defend our values, how to defend our country ultimately. And we shouldn't swap that for praise from a foreign government. We should do what we believe is in our national interest. So the government has to make a compelling case that it is better for Australia to get used submarines, and I'll be pursuing that with them in Senate estimates this week.
Senator, you've been critical of One Nation leader Pauline Hanson for her failure to attend Senate estimates. Do you think that Australians who support or are considering supporting One Nation care about Pauline Hanson's attendance at estimates?
They may or they may not, but I still think it's important, because senators are paid very well by taxpayers to do our job, and there's no more important forum for an opposition or crossbench senator than Senate Estimates. Some of the issues I've had the biggest impact on have been from questions I've asked at Senate Estimates, and if on 88% of the time Senator Hanson can't even be bothered showing up to do her job to advocate for her constituents, I think that reflects badly on her commitment to her job.
Yesterday on this program, I spoke with Tony Abbott, the new federal president of the Liberal Party, and he says that Liberals should remind voters that they are a patriotic party, the tradition party. Also criticised the PM for standing behind three flags and opposes acknowledgements of country. Should cultural issues be the focus? Are they the main driver of One Nation support, in your view?
My assessment is that support for non-major parties, including One Nation, is being driven by a range of factors. But ultimately, I think the biggest driver is the economy. I think it's the loss of living standards that Australians have suffered in the post-pandemic era, which has meant they're very disillusioned with the direction of their country and they are looking for alternatives. But they are also animated by cultural issues. They are animated by the flag and the anthem and Anzac Day. They're also very concerned about immigration. A major political party must have answers to all of those questions, because I think it's in Australia's interest that mainstream politics resolves those problems, solves them in a way that minor parties have no interest in actually solving them. They just want to mine them for political grievance.
And that is the Shadow Defence Minister there, Liberal Senator James Patterson. Well, thank you so much for listening to The Breakfast Wrap today. All of those interviews from Sally Sarah were produced by the Radio National Breakfast team, and The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Oscar Coleman. And a reminder, you can catch us every morning at 11:30 on Radio National, but slightly earlier on ABC Listen. And if you're listening on other platforms, make sure to hit follow and leave us a review. Let us know what you think of the program. Let your friends know as well. The more, the merrier. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. We'll see you tomorrow.